and leave a tip that could be anonymous. Redis's photo is on our website, WGTD.org. Sports, Justin Fields threw for 179 yards and a touchdown and ran for 82 yards and another score to give Chicago a 33-14 victory over New England in Monday Night Football. The forecast from the National Weather Service, scattered showers today and tonight, steady temperatures falling to around 55 by 5 p.m., heading to an overnight low of 44, wind switching to the northeast this afternoon. Then for tomorrow, gradual clearing, a high around 54. That's more in line with the normal high of 58 for this time of year. It'll be breezy tomorrow, windy with a northwest wind gusting up to 30 miles per hour. The five-day weather trend, dry with highs in the 50s, approaching 60. Sunset this evening at 5:53. Currently, we've got some sprinkles in the area, a temperature reading of 61. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Longtime listeners to the Morning Show may recall me saying on more than one occasion that one of the only lines of work that I really envy is that of the documentarian. And I really enjoy, maybe more than anything else with this program, interviewing talented documentarians about their films. And I look forward to today's program very, very much because we're going to be talking about two outstanding documentaries that recently aired on PBS and that are currently still available to be streamed via PBS.org. And they are films about two of the most important figures in our nation's history who both happen to be African-American. One of the films, Harriet Tubman, Visions of Freedom. The other, Becoming Frederick Douglass. And I am so happy to be able to speak with Nicole London, who had a hand in both of these wonderful films. As writer, co-producer, co-director of the Harriet Tubman film, co-producer, co-director of Becoming Frederick Douglass. And we'll spend the next few minutes talking with her about both of these remarkable films and the stories they tell of two remarkable Americans. Nicole London, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you so much, Gregory. It's a pleasure to be here.
I realize now that in preparing for this interview by watching both of these shows, I neglected to do my homework when it comes to you and your career. I wonder if we could start by hearing a little bit about how you got into the business of documentary films and some of the other things that you have done before these two particular films we're talking about today.
Sure. It's not a thing that I had originally set out to pursue when I went to college. I went to a school in Baltimore, Johns Hopkins, and I was pre-med at the time. Not a very good pre-med student, I might add. but upon graduating, I did some research, medical research, and I decided that that wasn't the path that I wanted for myself. Ultimately, I figured out that I wanted to work in television, so I went to broadcasting school, and very soon after that, I got my first job at a PBS show, To the Contrary in D.C. And since then, I've been almost steadily working with PBS almost exclusively. My first documentary that I had a hand in was Broadway, The Golden Age. That was about 2002, 2003, before I had been kind of in public affairs television. But I decided I liked the longer format of documentary. And since since then, this has been my home, documentary film, and I've never regretted it or looked back.
Hmm. Tell us about the specific way in which you came to have a hand in both of these films, the one about Harriet Tubman and the other about Frederick Douglass.
So MPT had realized, Maryland Public Television, had realized that they wanted to highlight two of their, arguably some of their, two of their most famous sons and daughters, Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman. And I think that they realized that here was a place that had birthed two people at the same place in the same time and like at the same location of Maryland that had such a huge impact on American history. And they wanted to kind of bring that forward, that Maryland was probably the only place that their story could have been possible. So they had reached out to Stanley Nelson to you know, kind of spearhead these films. And he reached out to me, having had a fairly long collaboration with Stanley. We'd just done the Miles Davis documentary, which was nominated for a Grammy and won a News and Documentary Emmy. And he said, you know, let's do these, and we'll do these two films in tandem. So that's how I came to be involved with them. You know, I was like, oh, that sounds like a great opportunity. And who better to, you know, kind of get my first directing credits on than Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass.
It is an interesting coincidence that both Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass were born in Maryland. And, of course, mm-hmm. one of the most interesting things about their story is Maryland itself, the kind of state that it was. In the years leading up to the war between the states as a border state. And this is something that is mentioned in both of these films. Explain to our listeners a little bit about what I'm talking about, what it meant to be a border state in the 1850s and leading into the Civil War, and how that figured in the lives of both Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman.
Right. Well, this was something that I hadn't really considered or knew about Maryland before. I knew it was a border state. I knew that slavery existed in Maryland as it's, you know, south of the Mason-Dixon line. But what was unique about Maryland specifically was that it was the way that slavery existed in Maryland. It didn't have a cotton industry, so it wasn't like that deep south, you know, large plantation slavery that most of us are familiar with. It was much smaller plantations, much smaller plots of land that had, you know, enslaved people working on them. But also specifically in Maryland, there was a whole different practices of how slavery played out. So, for instance, there was a practice of hiring out. Because you had smaller amounts of slaves, you would perhaps hire out your enslaved person to a neighboring plantation for a fee. So it was like almost like a temp agency, if you will, but except these were enslaved people. There was sometimes the opportunity for slaves to hire themselves out, which was, you know, certainly unusual. Harriet Tubman employed this method, and she was able to kind of earn some money with which she was hoping to purchase her own freedom. That, of course, never came to be, but she was able to kind of save money that was kind of going to help her in later years. And also the fact in Maryland especially is that about half the black population in Maryland was enslaved and about half was free. You know, about roughly 60,000, don't quote me on that number, but roughly 60,000 to 50,000 enslaved black Americans as well as free black Americans. So you could really see what freedom looked like for another black person. You could intermingle with them. You could, you know, you worked alongside them. And most importantly, possibly, was that you could marry someone that was free. And this, of course, provided, you know, incredible conundrums for, you know, couples who were half enslaved and half free. The enslaved person, of course, wanting to kind of either purchase or obtain their freedom by any means necessary. And that was the situation that both Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman found themselves in. Having both wed free black Americans and wanting, using that as a jumping point to really push for their own freedom.
Mm. And of course, the fact was that they, because Maryland was a border state, they could almost literally see freedom. I mean, right across the border, immediately to the north. A tantalizing possibility. And of course, they also lived, as did every other slave in Maryland and these other border states, lived with the real fear of being sold off to somebody and moved into the deep south, where becoming free would have been a much more remote possibility. When it comes to Harriet Tubman, well, first of all, I think we should have you explain the intriguing title of your film, Visions of Freedom. In a general sense, one can understand what that title is about, but there is also a very specific reason, unique to Harriet Tubman, why that title is so fitting. Explain.
Yes. So, of course, there's the literal meaning, Visions of Freedom, that she had an idea, almost a promise that she would obtain freedom and help others obtain freedom as well. But there was also, when we're thinking of this title, a more lyrical reason, a lyrical aspect to the title, in that Harriet Tubman was disabled. She was injured very young, probably a preteen. She was struck in the head with a heavy weight, which fractured her skull, and it gave her essentially seizures throughout the rest of her life. But these seizures, which we would possibly medically term seizures, she kind of, called them fainting spells. But she would also describe them as like visionary activity, prophetic activity, that God was speaking to her when she would fall into one of these almost like narcoleptic states. She would fall asleep, or she would fall into a seizure and faint. But she would also describe what she would see, pillars of fire, water rushing, hands reaching out to her. And she interpreted these episodes as messages from God. And so these visions, she figured them, she thought of them as like almost biblical visions that were directing her on what the avenues that she should take, first to get her own freedom, and then to go back when she had attained her freedom, to risk her own life and her own, safety, to go back and liberate others.
Amazing. One of the things that your film tells us about Harriet Tubman, this is something I did not know until I watched your film, is that at one point she got an interesting idea that ultimately kind of reshaped the nature of her own enslavement. And it was a way in which she, in a sense, brokered some control over the specifics of to whom she would be hired out and where she would go. This was huge in terms of shaping the experiences that she had and shaped the person that she became. Explain to our listeners this intriguing agreement, I guess we could almost call it, that she worked out with her own owner that, in a sense, helped shape some of the specifics of her destiny in the years that she was a slave.
Well, first and foremost, Harriet Tubman was an entrepreneur. I mean, she talked about smarts. She had street smarts. She had the smarts of nature, but she also knew how to kind of make money. It didn't allow her to purchase her own freedom, but she kind of knew, she was very shrewd in that she, as the way that slavery worked in Maryland, she had felt the lash of the whip. She had felt, the beating. And as she grew older and, gained more skills, she realized that there was a way that she could kind of purchase a little more safety for herself. But also kind of do the things that she actually wanted to do that would allow her to see her family, because they were scattered on more than one plantation. So the way that slavery existed, as I mentioned before, was that you could, an owner could hire Harriet out to another plantation, another owner. And she figured, she deduced that she had skills that would be valuable to other plantation owners. So she struck a deal with her own owner that, here's the deal. I can go to another plantation. You can hire me out, and I can do these jobs, and I'll cut you in. You could be cut in on this higher profit because I can do more at this other plantation and earn a higher wage, and then you get more money and I get more money. And so she was kind of able to kind of, you know, almost freelance herself out to other plantations, learning new skills, learning different landscapes than the one that she was, you know, originally working on. And so in this way, she was able to kind of broaden her horizon, broaden the people that she knew, learn more about the landscape of Maryland, and ultimately all of these things that she learned in this practice would enable her to help get her free.
It's just incredible. One gets a sense that she had some idea of how valuable this would be. I mean, and it Absolutely. Made such a difference in terms of the vision that she had for a new life for herself and a new life for her people. This is so crucial that she was able to do this. Your film also tells us that right around the year 1844, Harriet Tubman met and married John Tubman, who was himself a free man. And one of the most interesting things to try to understand is about their relationship and how complicated things became when Harriet Tubman wanted to, in a sense, seek freedom for herself. Explain kind of the complications of this with her husband, John.
Well, you know, this is the 1840s, and, you know, slavery is still the law of the land in a lot of places. And so there were a number of fugitive slave acts that were going around. So even a free black person could never be completely secure in that. But if you stayed where you were with the people that you knew, you were that much more, you know, comfortable, I suppose. So when Harriet was talking, I don't know what their conversations would have had about children, but any children they would have had would have been enslaved because she herself was enslaved. And so when looking at having a life, she always knew that she wanted to be free. But for him, it would have been a much more risky proposition to kind of leave the safety and comfort of, you know, the known freedom that he had in Maryland to perhaps give that up somewhere else, especially if they'd gotten caught. If they'd gotten caught, there's no guarantee that he would have been treated as a free person. You know, they could have been, you know, they could have both been, caught as, you know, people suspected of being enslaved and then sent further south. So there was a huge danger for him in perhaps trying to run away, you know, with Harriet. And so that, I mean, any free and enslaved marriage like that is, you know, is going to be fraught with that kind of conflict. But I suppose you would have to have one, a partner with like an extreme courage and fortitude to kind of take that chance. Unfortunately, John Tubman was not, I could say he wasn't that brave.
So it's interesting that Harriet Tubman then makes the decision to flee with her two brothers, Benjamin and Henry. And one of the things that prompts her to leave is that her slave owner had died. And the wife he left behind, his widow, was deeply in debt. And as so often would be the case, widows in that situation would sell off their slaves for the money. And so Harriet saw slaves on that plantation being sold off into slavery down into the Deep South, presumably, and did not want that fate for herself. So she makes the decision to flee with her two brothers. At that point in the film, we are shown the runaway ad that was run and we're told that this was something that happened all the time. These were published in newspapers all across the country, runaway ads, and we again see the actual ad, the typeset of the actual ad for Harriet and her two brothers, their owner seeking their return for a reward. It just makes you realize the odds were so stacked against a slave trying to escape enslavement in those days.
Oh, certainly. And that was a real revelation for me. again, I feel like so many people think they know the Harriet, the story of Harriet Tubman, especially. But it's like those kind of details that really impress upon a person the realities of her story, you know, the life that she lived and her story. The fact that there was a whole newspaper ad, you know, seeking to capture her, you know, it's crazy. And it was really profound to kind of see that and put that section together, because it was so common. In doing the research, we realized that there's a database that that's run out of, I believe, Cornell University, that has over 100,000 ads just like that of people who would run away to seek their freedom, and there's descriptions of them, and, you know, they ran away on this date, and they might be this cunning and might have a disguise, or they might be dressed as a woman in seeking their freedom. And it's so informative and chilling in some ways that, you know, this was so regular a practice, and slavery was so entrenched in the fabric of American society that this was just accepted. Incredible.
Mm. Well, ultimately, Harriet's brothers, say that it is safer for them to return back to Maryland and, in a sense, back to captivity. But then Harriet escapes once more on her own, and this time makes the 100-mile journey to Philadelphia, which your film tells us was a very important center for the abolitionist movement. And what a great place for Harriet Tubman to end up. By the way, in all of this, your film makes the point again and again that Harriet Tubman, in terms of physical stature, was a small woman, scarcely 5 feet tall. And that really helps us appreciate all that she goes on to accomplish in her remarkable life.
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's someone that, you know, would be very unassuming to look at, I suppose. You know, small, dark woman. But who knew what small packages can hold and what impact they can have on not just, you know, your life, but on the life and the course of history in America. So that she did this on foot, you know, especially that first time that she actually obtained freedom. She did this on foot. She walked herself into freedom. It's astounding to think about. But it also impresses upon, and I hope a lot of young people take this away, is that, you know, here's someone that had all the limitations that you could possibly have on you, not just being enslaved, but being a woman, a black woman enslaved, and being small, being illiterate in the terms that we understand it. You know, she could not read or write, but she had literacy in many other ways. But that never stopped her from obtaining her freedom and really having, putting her thumbprint on American history. It's just tremendous, a tremendous story that we can all learn from.
She goes on, of course, to be an ardent and effective abolitionist, and she becomes part of the speaking circuit. And, of course, this is also something that figures prominently in the life and career of Frederick Douglass as well. Explain the nature of this speaking circuit. It's kind of hard to imagine nowadays what this sort of looked like and the place that it had in American life in those days.
Well, it's actually not that hard. I mean, there's speakers bureaus now, and people go around and talk about their little TED Talks. Think of it in that way. There was like their TED Talks on abolition in the 1800s. And she would go around as someone especially who had lived the experience. One of the points that we wanted to underscore early on in both films is that the original abolitionists were the enslaved people themselves. Who more better to speak on what slavery is, the impact it has on a life, and why it should be abolished than someone who was enslaved? In tandem with that is that the Underground Railroad, of course, then had to be, if that's the case, then the Underground Railroad by necessity had to be a majority black operation, because how could it not be? I mean, anyone, you know, whites and blacks working together would be suspicious to see. But, you know, black people talking to each other, you know, relaying information, because, you know, they could just be working if you see them, you know, conversing with each other in small groups, of course. But that's something, that's how information could be relayed. There's no way the Underground Railroad would have worked without the participation of enslaved and free Black Americans. And so, yeah, the speaking circuit is like I said, kind of like a TED Talks of the day. What's amazing is that how, you know, widespread it could be and how many dates one could have. It was written about. Harriet Tubman was written about in the newspapers of the day as being someone who had liberated herself and telling her story. And so that was also really interesting to me to see that so much of her story was kind of documented at the time. But, you know, what we learn in school is so surface level to that. So when you go back and research, like, say, your New York Times or, your Boston Herald, whatever these old newspapers are, you go back and see the 1800s, you'll almost certain to find Harriet Tubman's name in them from this period.
Well, Harriet Tubman, of course, goes on to become one of the most tireless figures in the so-called Underground Railroad. And your film does a wonderful job of kind of chronicling some of those exploits as she returns to Maryland again and again and again. I think more than a dozen times she returns to Maryland with the intention of helping bring slaves out of their bondage into the freedom of the North. Your film goes on to tell us about a truly remarkable instance during the Civil War when Harriet Tubman began to play a slightly different role, but with the very, very same cause, as a spy for the Union and ultimately as a key figure in one of the most successful raids in the entire Civil War, when hundreds of people are brought out to freedom. Just briefly sketch a little bit of what I am talking about, this remarkable moment in the career of Harriet Tubman.
Right. So Harriet Tubman was, in a lot of ways, I call her the one-woman SEAL Team 6. Here was someone that, you know, could gather intelligence, used all her skills to, you know, penetrate enemy territory and bring out enslaved people. And that's just before, not even before the war happened. So once she goes south during, you know, once the war begins, she goes further south. And because she's done so much work on the Underground Railroad, because she's done work on the electric circuit, she was a really personable person. She knew how to talk to people. And working as a nurse, tending to, you know, soldiers, especially Black soldiers who had, you know, were involved in the war at that time, and especially what was called contraband, slaves who were liberated in some ways from the South, or, you know, either by just leaving or, you know, taken in by Union troops. She was gathering intelligence from them, what plantations they'd come from, what they'd seen while they were there, what the landscape was like between here and there, what she could expect what could be expected if they traveled further south, how many troops were on this plantation, how many armaments, that kind of thing. And so she was gathering this intelligence and, you know, went to the Union generals and said that we can devise a way to strike at a particular, this is the Combahee River raid that she's, you know, especially instrumental in attacking in this battle. She devised a way that they could go sail up the Combahee River because she knew the intelligence of where the landmines were hidden in the water. She knew what plantations were there, where they were located, how many troops were hiding on each plantation, how many armaments were on each plantation, and how many slaves were on each plantation. And so they sailed up the river, avoiding the landmines, and she's like on the hull of the boat singing. And, you know, there's, you know, breathless accounts in the newspapers of seeing this Black woman on the hull of a ship singing as they come sailing up the river. And they hardly had to fire any shots because when they saw this fleet of boats coming up, a lot of the troops fled, knowing that they didn't have a lot of resources, you know, to kind of defend themselves. But it's an incredible story, and I encourage everyone to read more about it beyond what they were able to include in the film. It's really thrilling.
It's an incredible story. It really, really is. And, of course, once the war is over and the hard work and the sometimes disappointing work of Reconstruction begins, Harriet Tubman continues to be a very, very active figure in the cause, ultimately befriending the likes of Susan B. Anthony and many others. So working hard for the cause, not only the cause of women's suffrage, and continuing to work for the betterment of the lives of other blacks. It's an incredible life, which ends in 1913 when she dies at the age of 91. And it's an incredible story you tell very well. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Nicole London, documentarian, talking about two different films that recently aired on PBS, available for streaming via PBS.org. Both of these films dealing with remarkable people from the state of Maryland, and the second, the brilliant Frederick Douglass. I wonder if you could just summarize for us the way in which you learned things about Frederick Douglass that you had not known before. I mean, what sort of experience of discovery was it for you? Or was it more that you already knew pretty much all of this, but had to figure out a way to shape it around a particular theme?
Oh, yeah. Well, Frederick Douglass as well. I assumed I knew a lot about him. I knew that he'd written his narrative. but I didn't, I guess I'd never really put together that he wrote three autobiographies. I never realized that he had had three, that he had been the most photographed man in America of the 1800s. That's something I never would have known outside of this film, I believe. And just how much that he actually did. I knew he'd been a statesman, but like the arc of his life, how much he was able to cram in, how he obtained his freedom, I never really had really dived into. So everything about Frederick Douglass was a revelation to me, because again, so much of what we learn in school is so surface level. I was in school a while ago, so the scholarship, of course, has advanced since I was in school or grade school. But it really impressed upon me how much more there is to learn about these two Americans.
One of the most interesting facets of the early life of Frederick Douglass, and it tells us so much about who he is to become, is an instance when he is a very, very young boy and a slave, and he is, in the words of one person in your film, trading biscuits for words. Trading biscuits for words. Explain to our listeners what that phrase entails and the significance of it in terms of what Frederick Douglass would ultimately go on to do and accomplish.
Yeah, so, he talks about in his autobiography about being sent to Baltimore, I guess because he was one of the better workers. Who knows? He was one of the better workers. He was supposed to be kind of minding the owner's son. And there's a passage that we ultimately had to cut out of the film, but he talks about being hungry as a slave, that, you know, there was often not enough to eat. And as slaves, they were fed from an actual trough, like a pig's trough. And so he was always kind of a hungry little boy. But when the owner's wife would give them biscuits, he would able to, get some biscuits. He's someone who was hungry, but who risked his hunger, who decided that being hungry for knowledge was more important than the hunger in his body. So when he was trading those biscuits, he was literally trading something that would sustain him for a day, keep him going. He was trading those biscuits to learn words from other boys because he thought sustaining his mind, his intelligence, and ultimately his own self-worth was more important than feeding himself, literally feeding himself and keeping his belly full. It's really profound, and, it's something I hope that people can take away from his story.
Mm. And the way he ultimately is able to wield words is absolutely extraordinary. One thing your film tells us is that the story of Frederick Douglass might not have unfolded the way it did were it not for a woman he meets in Baltimore named Anna Murray. Tell us why Anna Murray is so crucial to the story of Frederick Douglass and, in a sense, his personal evolution?
Well, I'll tell you, first of all of my girlfriends, when they'd heard that I was doing a story directing a podcast on Frederick Douglass, they was like, you have to talk about Anna Marie Douglass. There's no way you cannot mention her. She never gets mentioned. I was like, I will, no way. and, of course, one of his descendants in the film, Ken Morris, is of the same mind. And, you know, if we could do more on Anna Marie Douglass, we would have. But, yeah, she was absolutely essential to his life and to his getting his freedom. As I mentioned in Harriet Tubman, she was a free black woman that lived in Baltimore. And when they met and married, she knew that she didn't want their children to be enslaved or their father to be enslaved. And so her input, her resources, is really what made his obtaining his freedom possible. And then, of course, beyond that, you know, in terms of, you know, getting him a suit that he could wear that would disguise him as a sailor to get up to New York to freedom, that her whatever monies that she had put together would help fund their life beyond that. But she was also someone that was not literate. And so the fact that she was able to do all these things, you know, although she was free, but she did have that, you know, kind of a drawback to her, is really remarkable. It's kind of a lament that we don't see him write much about her, but then it could be that she didn't want him to write about her. Well, we might never know, but you can't state enough how important she is to his story, and then, of course, you know, writ larger, the story of America.
Well, ultimately, Frederick Douglass is able to escape to the North and makes a name for himself, in part because of meeting one of the most important abolitionists of the era, a man by the name of William Lloyd Garrison. Is that his last name? The editor of The Liberator.
Yes.
And Frederick Douglass, a bit like Harriet Tubman, ends up traveling the lecture circuit and is an extraordinary force. Explain to our listeners what he did when charges began to be raised, doubts raised about whether or not Frederick Douglass was in fact a former slave. Why were some people doubting that was possible?
I think it was because he was too articulate, too good looking. he was just too much everything, too good a speaker. And so, you know, it became, he's like, I don't know, this guy can't be it. There's no way this man could have been a slave. He's too dignified. He's just too much. And so I think that's how, that's one why he needed to write his own story and name it as, you know, as narrated, as written by himself, so that people would know that this is my story. Despite the way I look, this is the experience I've had. And especially because of this, because of how I present myself, because of how I speak and how learned I am, what right is there to hold anyone in bondage? You know, look at the potential that I hold within myself. We're holding other people back from this potential.
You've already touched on the fact that Frederick Douglass was very often photographed. In fact, very likely the most photographed man of the 19th century, black or white. And part of it was because he understood the power of the photograph, maybe more so than just about anybody of his time. Explain what he saw as the great sort of liberating potential of the photograph and the photographic image.
What's remarkable, especially about Douglass and his understanding of the photograph, is that photography is in its infancy. It had only existed maybe 10 to 15, maybe 20 years. So the fact that he knew and understood what photography could mean, that this is a real representation of a person rather than a portrait which is an artistic interpretation of a person, that this was a kind of document. It was a kind of proof of what one's eyes and experience was telling them. And they understood that if I could present myself, if Black Americans could present themselves as they actually are, as they actually look, then that would help kind of refute the stereotypic images that were so prevalent of the time. That would refute the idea that Black Americans were subhuman, that would refute the idea that slavery was a viable institution that could continue. And so he understood that representation matters. And so he acted upon that by, you know, presenting himself as the chief example against all of that. It's really incredible to think about that there's someone at, you know, over 100 years ago that understood that. It's amazing.
Absolutely. And at one point, one of the guests in your film says, in a sense, Frederick Douglass was not afraid of the camera. And then we see one image after another in which that really proves to be true. There is something about the way he is staring right at the lens of the camera and in a sense relishing the opportunity for the camera to capture his majestic figure and face. And it's really amazing to think about the power of that. Let's spend a couple of minutes talking about Frederick Douglass's somewhat complicated relationship with our 16th president, Abraham Lincoln. And I appreciate the fact that your book takes the time to do this. Your film takes the time to explore the complexity of their relationship, and in a sense, the fine line that Abraham Lincoln was walking in 1860 as he was running for and ultimately elected U.S. president at such a turbulent point in our history.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we couldn't delve into it as much as we wanted to, having a film that's a little under an hour and trying to tackle as much, even though we called it Becoming Frederick Douglass and limited it to a point pretty much right after the Civil War. He did so much in that time and had so much influence on so many people. It was really a challenge. But, yeah, his relationship with Lincoln was incredibly interesting. The fact that he had the ear of the president and could influence him in any way. I do believe he went to the inauguration. And he is photographed there, but very small. It's very hard to see in the sea of faces that are there. But, you know, Lincoln welcomed him with open arms at that inauguration. So I don't know if you could really call it so much a friendship as, you know, but it was a relationship. And it's incredible that someone that had kind of become, you know, gotten himself out of slavery was able to rub shoulders with the sitting president. It's really remarkable. But absolutely, he had an influence on Lincoln's decision, especially in terms of allowing Black soldiers to participate in the war. And his own two sons served as well. So, I mean, we couldn't go into the finer details, but we did want to make a point to highlight that they had this relationship and that, you know, Frederick Douglass was instrumental in kind of, you know, helping Lincoln shape what his policy would be, especially regarding slavery.
Mm. Towards the end of your film, the statement is made that Frederick Douglass was one of the most complicated people in our nation's history. What made Frederick Douglass so complicated?
I think it was complicated for the time, and I guess, you know, looking back at the time he lived in, he was complicated. I don't find him so much complicated as you know, fascinating. But his later life might have been complicated. There's this whole confusing situation with women in his life. Later on, he married a white woman later on in his life, but he himself was thought to be half white, so I'm not sure that's part of it. But he did have a complicated relationship with a German woman. But I think that one of the things that they, people think of, well, I just imagine people think of him being complicated, was that he was fairly radical for the time. You know, when we think about, you know, 4 million slave people, enslaved people, we often think about them in terms of, you know, like the benevolence. You know, here he's a speaker, you know, he's an orator, he's kind of gentle, he's a gentle man in that way. But he was really kind of radical in his thinking about how some Black Americans could handle obtaining their freedom. He thought, especially during when the Fugitive Slave Act was enacted in 1850, that one way to kind of combat that was to, you know, just to make a few dead kidnappers. that, you know, kind of tacitly giving Blacks the idea, saying you could, you know, if you had to kill to obtain your freedom, if you had to kill to maintain, you know, to make sure that you weren't kidnapped back into slavery, you should do so. And I think that in a lot of ways was considered radical. It's like a Nat Turner kind of attitude towards enslavement that a lot of people, I don't think, subscribe to him then or now. Perhaps that's what people are thinking about when they say complicated. But, you know, I think complicated is really just another way to say that he was a man like any other who had, you know, flaws, who had, had some, you know, vices to some, and who had, attitudes that were not as, maybe not as benevolent as everybody thinks of historical figures. We always think of him in his, like, benign past life, but he was a flesh and blood man who had attributes wonderful and some flaws as well.
Mm. And of course, a fierce advocate for justice and mm-hmm. not afraid of anything or anyone. And of course, a man of remarkable eloquence. And I so appreciate the fact that your film includes searing, incredible examples of that gift, including his marvelous statement on what is the 4th of July to a slave, which really resonates powerfully to this very day. Both films are beautifully done. The one we've been just talking about called Becoming Frederick Douglass. Before that, we talked about Harriet Tubman, Visions of Freedom. Both of these films coming from Maryland Public Television, since both of these people born in Maryland and an important part of that state's history. And both of these films, which have already aired on PBS, can be viewed via the streaming of PBS.org. And I urge everybody listening to this to seek out both films and to watch them. You will learn a lot. And one of the people responsible largely for both of these films, Nicole London. Nicole London, thank you so much for taking time to have this conversation with me, and congratulations on the great work you did on both of these films.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me.